in the months prior to September 2001 when, according to then CIA Director George Tenet, the system was blinking red. And here we are nearly two decades later, and I'm here to say the warning lights are blinking red again.
Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats sounding the alarm earlier this month about nefarious activity ahead of this fall's elections. And today, Facebook said, yeah, we're seeing that. Facebook reports it has uncovered an ongoing influence campaign, fake accounts and fake pages focused on divisive social issues and the election. Facebook isn't pointing fingers yet, but the ads look similar to those linked to Russian groups. And the company says the effort has been effective. One of the pages in question reached nearly 300,000 people. April Glazer covers tech for Slate. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Okay, what does Facebook say it found? And come on, it's the Russians, right?
Well, it's hard to say. They are not definitively putting those two together yet. But one of the pages that was found was called Resistors, and it did for a moment have a IRA, an Internet Research Agency, which is the Kremlin troll farm, one of those linked accounts. Was an admin to one of the pages that was just removed this morning. So there are some connections, but they're not definitively saying that these 37 pages were puppeted by Russian trolls.
But they are saying we are facing, and this is a quote from their announcement, determined, well-funded adversaries.
Yes, and they're saying that they're going to have to move quickly, and they're going to have to try to kind of understand what their adversaries are going to be doing before they do it in order to catch them as quickly as possible. This is certainly a moving target for Facebook, but unlike last year, where when they knew for over a year that there was Russian interference on their platform, before they disclosed it in a public post, this time they said they did it within 2 weeks of finding it. So a very different tact.
All right. What are the pages that they suspended? What are these pages and what did they want people to do?
Right. So just to put it in perspective, there were 8 pages on Facebook, 17 profiles on Facebook that were suspended, and 7 Instagram accounts. One of the pages was called As Clan Warriors. One was Black Elevation. One was called Mindful Being. The Warriors page was seems to be kind of about Native American identity and pride. The Black Elevation page also seems to be about racial justice, which was a theme that was used a lot in the lead up to the 2016 election that Russian trolls really hammered on and created thousands of ads and posts about. Another page was called Mindful Being, which appears to be kind of like a sci-fi mindfulness kind of meditation focused page. One of the pages, though, Resistors, that was disclosed, was organizing an event prior to the Unite the Right 2 rally, which is the sequel to the kind of alt-right white supremacist rally that happened last year in Charlottesville. This year it's happening in Washington, D.C., and the Russian, or not Russian, rather, but the disinformation page that was removed did have an event organized that had attracted thousands of people that said they were going to attend.
So what would have happened if they had actually attended?
It's hard to say, but they certainly did work with authentic Facebook pages to drum up support for this event. Facebook said that 5 different pages with authentic admins were included as admins for the event that the trolls had organized.
Wow. And so all of these that you mentioned, they would, I guess, purportedly be linked to the left or people on the left. So what is the general idea behind this? Is it just to sow division?
It seems at this point that the idea is to keep divisions, very, very strong in the United States, to make sure that the country remains as polarized as it is now and trying to keep that polarization intact. We see posts about women's rights, about revolutionary leaders and folks that that people who you might adhere to strong right or conservative politics would roll their eyes to, but people who consider themselves, on the left and maybe even a radical affiliation of the left would certainly cheer. So these do appear to be courting leftist supporters.
Interesting. And the same thing is happening on Twitter, right? They suspended a bunch of accounts recently.
Yes, Twitter has been working to purge trolls from its platform. They have not linked recent purges to the Internet Research Agency, but you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, they all have removed thousands of accounts that were linked to Russian trolls since the 2016 election. So this is an ongoing battlefield for the social media giants.
And are they working with the government on this, or are they on their own?
They are working with the government somewhat. I mean, they certainly are disclosing to the government. Facebook did say that it's working with the FBI and that they shared with Congress what they found. They also said that that pages that have been shared by Congress have led to them finding more pages. So, in other words, more communication has helped. So, based on leads from the Department of Justice, from the indictment, from the Mueller indictment earlier this year, Facebook was able to find, you know, another group that it says had 4,000 members that was an inauthentic group. So clearly there's some level of coordination, but it's not clear that there is enough right now. There was a report, I believe it was last month in the New York Times, that said that technology companies were feeling like they weren't getting the level of information they needed from the federal government in order to purge their platforms from dangerous and misleading accounts.
Thanks, April. That's April Glazer. She's a tech writer for Slate. All right, President Trump sowed his own divisions on social media today with a series of tweets slamming the Kochs. He called its influential network of Republican donors highly overrated. And he said the globalists, he called them billionaire brothers, have become a total joke in real Republican circles. We should mention one of the brothers, David Koch, stepped down from both the family business and the political groups last month because of his health, his declining health. The other brother, Charles, has been a vocal critic of the Trump administration's tariffs and its hardline stance on immigration. And at the network's twice annual gathering in Colorado this past weekend, the network said it would not back the GOP candidate in a key Senate race. Joining us now to talk about what the Koch network has been up to is Julie Baikowitz. She covers money and influence in national politics for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what happened at the Koch network's meeting this weekend that got the president all riled up?
Well, really, it was some discussion that came out of a longer running consideration that the Koch network has had about its approach to politics, and in particular, its approach to Republican candidates. Officials with the Koch network, so not just Charles Koch, but leaders of the various different groups that the brothers have traditionally funded, have felt like their donations are taken for granted in some ways. So they've been looking at ways to sort of make it clear to Republican candidates that they can't just automatically count on support from the well-funded donors that buy into the Koch network. And so this flared up over the weekend because there was talk specifically about a candidate in North Dakota who's running against Senator Heidi Heitkamp. And this is viewed as a potential pickup for Republicans at a time when they're really sort of eager to hold on to as many seats as possible and possibly even pick up one or two. So the donors have said that they are not going to, at this point in time, be active in the North Dakota Senate race with Kevin Cramer.
Because they don't agree with his policies?
Yeah, specifically, Mr. Cramer has been very supportive of President Trump, and that extends to support on the president's approach to tariffs and trade. And so that's really where sort of the rub is with the Koch network, because the Koch brothers and the groups that they fund really have vehemently opposed what President Trump is doing on tariffs and trade. And so they see this Senate race as a way to sort of weigh in and, you know, again, sort of assert that they're not just automatically going to be for any Republican candidate out there. And that drew Trump's attention this morning.
Mm-hmm. But they're not going to put money into Heidi Heitkamp's campaign.
You know, not so far, but it's sort of interesting because earlier this year there was some advertising, not a huge amount, but some advertising that the Koch network did to thank Senator Heitkamp on a couple of key issues for them. So they're wading in a little bit here and there in that race. And sort of the big news would be that they aren't going to support the Republican candidate.
Well, is this all at the discretion of Charles Koch? The network has a donor base of, what, 500 people?
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, they have different opinions on this, and some of them might support Kevin Cramer and others that Charles Koch does not. So is there any dissent within the Koch network?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it does kind of flare up in a couple of different ways. When it comes to support of the Koch-funded groups like Americans for Prosperity, that's a grassroots group that sort of goes door-to-door talking with voters in key races. So something like that would not be active in the North Dakota race. But of course, with 500 different people who are part of this network, any number of those donors can choose to support Kevin Cramer on his or her own. And in fact, some of the donors at the Colorado Springs Conference said that they certainly will continue to do that and weren't terribly happy with the decision to, you know, have the larger groups in the Koch network not support Kevin Cramer. So there is certainly dissension among the donors themselves, too.
Right. And the Kochs did not support Donald Trump when he was running in 2016. But apparently after he was inaugurated, they decided to make nice and tried to work with him. And that, I guess, didn't pan out.
Well, no, it's actually has gone pretty well so far, particularly when you think about what are some of the big things that Charles and David Koch over the years have advocated for. You know, really topping that list is tax cuts. And so the Koch network was very supportive of President Trump's tax legislation that he signed at the end of the year. And in fact, the Koch groups have spent millions of dollars advertising to sort of gin up support for the tax cuts, seeing that as a good way to sort of help Republican candidates ahead of midterms this fall. The Kochs have also been very happy with the judicial picks by the president and also some of the areas that he has deregulated in his first year and a half of office. And those are all things actually that the president pointed out in his series of tweets this morning when he was saying that the Kochs are a total joke. He also pointed out that they've been very happy with those sort of decisions that he's made and said, you know, basically that they have gotten rich in part because of him. So that was sort of an interesting approach for the president to take.
Well, have they reacted to that or just let it go?
They have a spokesman for the Koch network. You know, when I asked this morning what to make of the tweets and how they were sort of responding to that, they sort of demurred. And a spokesman told me that they support any policy to help people improve their lives and that they look forward to working with anyone who would do so. I think kind of reading between the lines there, what they're saying is, you know, at times when they agree with President Trump, they will continue to try to work with him. That certainly applies to some veterans issues where they both want to see more privatization. And it also applies to criminal justice when they sort of find common ground in ways to kind of change the criminal justice system. But they're just kind of reiterating that they're not necessarily always going to be with the president on every single issue.
Right. So he clearly saw the attack on Kevin Cramer or the decision not to support Kevin Cramer as an attack on him personally.
Yeah, and I think that this really is a very comfortable area for the president. All throughout the 2016 campaign, he loved attacking the other Republican candidates for their sort of reliance on big donors like the Koch brothers. I was taking a look at some of his older tweets this morning and just was really reminding myself how many times he referred to other Republican presidential candidates as quote-unquote puppets of major donors, including singling out the Koch brothers by name, and really just kind of running down the list. He would always, at different debates and on Twitter, you know, mention that these other candidates had to rely on donor funding. And of course, at first during the primary, Trump was largely self-funding his own campaign. So it is an area of rhetoric where he really feels like he gets a lot of support from his base and even beyond. And you can just sort of see him steering back into that comfort zone over time.
So maybe he doesn't need their support because he has his own money, but certainly candidates who need to raise money would need their support, and he needs them to win to carry out his agenda.
That is a very rational, highly political way of looking at things. And I don't necessarily think that the president's politics team was loving the tweets this morning. But, you know, this is a president who will see something on television or hear about something, read something, and react kind of instantly and at a gut level to it. And this really feels a lot like what he was doing this morning when he saw coverage of the Colorado Springs event.
Julie Bykowitz, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why MoviePass imploded and what that means for the movie subscription idea. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Got MoviePass? How's that working out for you? MoviePass burst on the scene a while back, promising to change movie going forever. Pay a monthly $10 fee, and you get to see a movie a day if you want. Well, that deal changed a number of times. Subscribers are upset. The company is scrambling. Investors are giving up. The stock price fell below a dollar today. Trading on the NASDAQ was halted. So will MoviePass survive? Maybe not, says our next guest, but the idea of MoviePass could live on. Alyssa Wilkinson is film critic for Vox. Hi, Alyssa.
Hello.
Well, MoviePass shut down on Friday, leaving some Mission Impossible fans hanging. What happened?
Basically, the company ran out of money and needed an emergency infusion of cash. You know, they pay full price to the studios and to the movie theaters for the tickets, and they just ran out of money. And suddenly, people couldn't see movies. Showtimes were grayed out. And this was happening all across the country.
Right. Well, it certainly seems that the basic idea of it is financially unsustainable, that you pay, what, $10 a month and get to see whatever you want. How can they possibly make money off that?
Right. And as of today, it's $15 a month. And we'll see if that actually helps. I mean, they had a whole plan. One part of it was the gym membership idea, which is that people will pay, but they'll forget to use it. And so it'll all kind of balance out. Another piece of this is they were really hoping that studios and distributors might partner with them, maybe give them a cut of the profits or pay them for special placement in the app. And that eventually the tipping point would kind of happen where their subscriber base was big enough that they could kind of throw their weight around. And they have a huge subscriber base, but that doesn't seem to have worked out in their business model yet.
Right. Well, who could resist that deal? Of course, they have a big subscriber base. I guess I'm wondering if they wanted to make money by other means, such as selling user data.
The majority ownership of the company is held by a data mining firm. So certainly that is something that they've talked about somewhat freely. They like to know what you eat when you go to the movies. They like to know where you go to the movies and what your habits are. Possibly even they had floated the idea of seeing what route you take when you go to the movies and offering you maybe deals in the future with restaurants so you could have kind of a package deal. There was a lot of ideas that have been swirling around for the past several years with MoviePass, and none of them seem to stick. You know, businesses do this all the time, but it does mean that subscribers have kind of been jerked around a lot.
So what now? Will subscribers still hang on, do you think?
I mean, I think a lot of people will hang on as long as it feels to them like they are getting their money's worth. And that's really not hard, even at $15 or $20 a month. I live in New York City. A ticket will cost you $18. So if I go twice a month, I'm already making more money back myself. But whether that, you know, is going to last very long is the big question. I think the bigger thing that's true is that MoviePass has introduced the idea of a subscription model to a very large number of consumers. And some movie theaters are following suit. For instance, AMC recently introduced a program where you pay $20 a month. You can see three movies a week at AMC theaters, and that includes 3D movies. You can see repeat movies, you know, and this is hopefully very profitable for AMC, and it also might be a model that works out better. But the fact is, people like subscription models, especially young people like subscription models. It's predictable. You get your money's worth. And I think MoviePass's idea is one that is sustainable, even if the price point that they put on it was not.
Well, how would the theaters make money if they're not charging the same amount as they would for a single ticket? How would they make money? Is it off other things like the popcorn?
Yeah, concessions are a really big part of their model. And a lot of AMC theaters seem to be sinking a lot of money into having nicer concessions. So sort of going with the model that some other theaters, for instance, Alamo Drafthouse, have gone with, which is that they don't charge you very much for the ticket. They have a very high rewards program. But when you get there, you buy a couple of beers, maybe you might even have dinner, so that it becomes closer to like going to a concert or going to maybe a play than just showing up and seeing a movie and hoping that, you know, your feet don't stick to the floor too much and there's not too much popcorn around you.
And does MoviePass and these other subscription models, do they change consumer behavior? Like, are you more apt to go see kind of a not so good movie, a Bad Moms, let's say, if you have the subscription model?
Yeah, so the studies about MoviePass have shown that people's viewing habits really, really changed once they became a subscriber. And the big groups that seem to benefit from it, interestingly enough, are parents. So it's expensive to go to a movie. You have to get a babysitter, all these different things. And cutting one of the pieces out of that equation has been helpful. People are also more likely to take a risk on a movie that they've kind of heard about, but they're not sure if they're going to like it. So MoviePass users tend to go twice as much to the theater as non-MoviePass users. And they also tend to see movies that maybe critics might praise, but they don't know for sure is going to be a slam dunk, or maybe it doesn't have any recognizable movie stars in it. So in a lot of ways, it's a huge boon for independent film and art house film. Also, in some cities like New York, for instance, it works at all of our art house and repertory cinemas, which means you might go see an old movie or a classic or something that you wouldn't have seen otherwise if you had to pay the full price. And that means people are seeing more movies in theaters, which for people who love movies is a really great outcome. But the question is whether the movie theaters can stay open if people are expecting the cost to go down.
Alyssa Wilkinson is film critic for Vox. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, fires, politics, the news is stressful. One reason why gentle TV shows are popular now.
On this show, maybe because of the slow pace and nature of everything and how everything's very sweet, I do get invested in these couples and I want them to smile at each other.
How to make a drama-free reality show that's addictive, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time to talk TV.
No one told you that was...
This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are the four myths. The actual retail price is...
Okay, so today on TV on the Radio, our weekly segment, we want to talk about a genre we don't often discuss, reality TV.
Why would you not?
I'm never going to tell
you.
I'm never going to tell you.
Are you kidding?
You're going to twist this and make this my fault for not telling you that I knew he was dating
anybody
somebody?
Anybody would say that's f***ed up.
Kelly, no.
Anybody would say.
Don't point your finger at me.
Okay, okay. No, we're not going to talk about that kind of reality TV. More like this.
もともとそんなに素を見せないタイプなんでしょう。もともとなんか恥ずかしがり屋なのか。ああ。そう。
恥ずかしい感じたまにあるけど。
ある？
そう、なんか顔真っ赤に
してるけど。That is Terrace House. It's a Japanese TV show. It's on Netflix. In that scene, Tsubasa goes on a date with Shion. They're at an onsen, that's a hot spring, and while they're dipping their feet in the foot bath, Shion asks Tsubasa why she isn't more forthcoming, more open with him. And she says she's shy by nature. He tells her he can see that when she blushes. Then she laughs. It's the beginning of their romance, but nothing happens on that date. And that's usually how the show goes. You can wait 15 episodes just to see a kiss. There are no fights, no drama. Everyone is respectful. So why does anyone watch it? To explain this and to discuss the larger trend of no drama reality TV, we have Han Nguyen. She is senior editor for IndieWire. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And Joshua Rivera is a GQ contributor. Welcome to you.
Hi.
Okay, you both love this show, right?
That doesn't even describe it, but yes.
Really? So you are forthcoming. You're not being shy about it.
Oh, not for this one at all. And it's kind of been an embarrassing thing because I don't really watch a lot of reality TV. And then when people ask me why I like it, I've been trying to explain it too. Because I'm not a shipper. I watch a lot of TV and I don't ship people except on this show.
Okay, you have to explain shipping for the over 20-year-olds?
Yeah, so shipping, short for like relationship, right, is just, you know, when you want two characters to get together on a show, and that might mean dating, it might mean something more than that. And so I never really understood this sort of, these are false character, like fake characters on TV shows, even on reality shows, I kind of don't care. I'm not a nosy person in life, but on this show, maybe because of the slow pace and nature of everything and how everything's very sweet, I do get invested in these couples, and I want them to smile at each other longingly. And maybe
so
someday.
There is some tension there that they're building up.
Yes.
Joshua, why do you like this show?
I mean, it's just very, very chill. And it's not just the relationships, too. Although, like, I lost my mind at that footbath because you wait for so long for it, right? But it's also just, like, this very sort of, like, centering thing. Like, oh, this is how people actually talk to each other.
But why do you need to watch that on TV if you have that in reality?
Do we have it in reality, though?
Well, I guess that's the question. Do we? Is this an escape from our reality that is not so nice?
I would say it's different because I think one of the things that appeals to me about the show is very, very Japanese. And so this sort of slower pace of courtship is something that we don't see a lot here in America, especially on reality TV, where it's just sort of a hookup culture. The shyness is maybe that's something you'd see in grade school. And so it makes it simpler. It makes it maybe more straightforward for us to root for them.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely like a throttling back that's fun because it's not quite like real life, right? Like there's a progression and, you know, things sort of make sense and people come and go. But like people behave like they would in real life, you know, or at least ideally.
Is there something also about the fact that, I mean, Han was saying, look, this is a window into Japanese culture that we don't often see. Is there something to that?
There's definitely sort of like a tourism to it, right? Uh-huh. Where it's just sort of like, you know, you see how these people live. And like, as far as you can tell, they're living, you know, just these very not glamorous, regular, everyday lives, you know, in Japan. So it's just sort of like they wear slippers in the house, you know, they cook foods that we don't eat, you know, and that's fun to watch. That's another thing about the show. They live their regular lives, right? It's not like, you know, Big Brother where the show is their job. They have school, they have work, and they have, you know, like sports if the member of teams, you know, and it's fun to watch all that play out.
Han, you know, reality TV here is often not reality, right? I mean, a lot of people think that these are actors or the producers are juicing the action, basically unscripted TV is what it's really called, because it isn't really reality. What's the situation here? Is there more verisimilitude?
I would like to say that, as we've seen, well, sort of highlighted in Unreal, sometimes situations can be manufactured on a reality show. So they might have true reactions, but that sort of situation wouldn't have happened. So I think on Terrace House, I would like to say I believe it more because of the slower pace, that and it takes place over several episodes that might be condensed into one. But that's not to say that there are not false things that we see. We've witnessed two characters actually kind of lie to the camera and hide their relationship, and it didn't come out until later, and that was scandalous. So,
but again, there are no histrionics. No one's wig is being ripped off. There's no screaming. There's none of that.
There's some very earnest discussions. this is kind of where I get back to the sort of like the idea of it's very Japanese in that like everyone is supposed to work for, you know, to improve themselves, be hard workers, but also to, for the betterment of the community, which is their house. So if one person doesn't, you know, step up, then, you know, everyone sort of, I don't want to say gangs up on him, but they have a talk with him. And usually the eldest person will feel responsible for setting this person straight and giving advice. And it's not seen like on reality shows here where you're like, you're not my dad. What the hell are you saying? But this one is like, no, you're right. You're right. But there's a little bit of drama. I have to say there was one portion where someone ate some really expensive Kobe meat and I was very upset too. And he was upset. And... So that's about the level of real drama that you get.
But he ate someone else's Kobe beef?
Well, he got an expensive Kobe beef gift from a client. He put it in the fridge, and he even mentioned it to his girlfriend because he had a girlfriend at that point. This is, you know, very special to me. And then when he was gone, she and the other housemates cooked it.
What?
Ate it. And even one person's like, should we save some, him some? They're like, nah. And I would have been so upset.
I'm shocked.
He was upset. He was in. Yeah. No, it was not good.
There's a lot of about food, I understand, in this, in this show. A lot about the cooking and the eating and the talking about. And
well, in that way, I feel very much at home. I'm kind of obsessed with food. When I eat it, I talk about the next meal. I think about the next meal. And so I think it's very much a, I don't want to say it's an Asian culture thing, but it kind of is.
Well, speaking of food, also an import and also related to food. This is on PBS, The Great British Baking Show. Similar, no drama. I mean, when you compare it to MasterChef, it just seems really like a lovely walk in the countryside.
Well, you don't get Gordon Ramsay yelling at you and putting your face between bread and saying that you're an idiot sandwich. that's for sure. That's not to say that there aren't some pretty colorful language. I think Mary, who is a judge, well, she's no longer I think over in the UK, they're way beyond us now. But she has very colorful language in the way she describes failed attempts, soggy bottoms, unproved, and things like that. But
these are all like baking terms.
But these are baking terms. And so that makes it okay, sure.
And Josh, is there something also here about the gentleness that we are attracted to?
I think so. Mostly because it's just sort of like, you know, I don't watch a show, but like I have a lot of friends who do. And, you know, they come away from it thinking like, oh, I can do this too. In a way that like, you know, just watching like a Food Network show wouldn't necessarily motivate you to, right? Where that's that is the feel of looking up a recipe and Great British Bake Off, you know, the way people talk about it to me, it's just, oh, here are these nice people that are doing this thing that I can also do.
People are pretty obsessive about this show.
Yeah, I think it's because, yes, it's a competition show, but it's not a backstabbing show. Like, I think Top Chef has been one of those where somehow they can sabotage each other. But this one, they actually seem to be rooting each other on, which I think is actually pretty sweet. And that might just be part of the Britishness of it.
So is this, we're talking about two foreign shows. Is this just a difference between American culture and other cultures?
I think it's a difference of between the American approach to entertainment and reality TV in specifics, right? Where... like you were talking about in the intro, right? It's very extremely confrontational. A lot of things are compressed and, you know, loud and attention-grabbing. It doesn't have that sort of, like, I guess you would say quiet confidence in the material or just, like, watching people be languid and silent for a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Are Americans, though, making TV like this, gentle TV?
Yeah, I actually think that maybe it's not necessarily a cultural thing because England has also made some really scary reality shows that we've based our stuff on.
Like, say, like Gordon Ramsay's British, by
the way. Yeah, Gordon Ramsay, but then also like the Get Me Out of Here, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here stuff. So they've had their share of dramatic things. Some Japanese game shows are definitely kind of stressful for me to watch. But I think maybe it might be the zeitgeist. And so America is starting to try to make it. And I believe there's actually a very new show premiering tonight, is called Making It on NBC. And some people have compared it to the Great British Baking Show, but with crafts. And it has Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman as the hosts.
Oh, from Parks and Rec.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like a little mini reunion from Parks and Rec. And even though they're not their characters, they might as well be. Because Amy Poehler is just as sunny as Leslie Knope sometimes. And Nick Offerman actually is a really good woodworking craftsman.
In real life.
Yeah. And so that has, you know, that has leaked into Ron Swanson a bit. But yeah, so I think I'm excited to see if American can do it right.
So they're making things. That's what it's about?
Yeah, they're making things. We'll see.
That's the loose concept.
Yeah. It's not as focused as sweets.
Okay. Yeah. And also one of my favorites, which seems to be enjoying an afterlife, and that is Bob Ross and The Joy of Painting. That is perhaps the gentlest of TV shows, aside from Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, that's interesting because Mr. Rogers is also enjoying a sort of a renaissance heyday.
Thanks to the documentary.
I think a lot of people in scripted have tried to sort of call this like nice core or warm bath TV. And so Bob Ross, not only is his voice so soothing and like ASMR, and maybe gives you that little, you know, warm fuzzies up your back, but I think it's very satisfying to see him create something on screen and see a finished product. And it's also nature. It's not, he's not painting like Guernica, you know?
Right. So. Yeah, they're all landscapes.
Yeah, they're landscapes. It's very nice.
Can you imagine Bob Ross's Guernica?
He would make it so nice.
Happy little
Spanish Civil War. It's a nice, nice thing.
I think there's a sort of a type of TV people like to leave on in their backgrounds. It could be laundry folding TV, whatever you want to call it. And there's nothing better. And it could flow from one episode to the next, and you really might not notice. but I think there's a I think people like having a little bit of noise in the background, but it doesn't have to be, you know, dramatic noise.
Mm.
If everyone's cutting cords and no one has, you know, no one really puts on cable or, you know, like rabbit ears anymore, right? There's no real equivalent to just like having something on, just turning it on and leaving it on. Everything has to be, you know, if you're streaming all the time, everything has to be an act of choice, right?
Yeah.
So maybe there is a viable reason to have a whole category of things that are just nice to leave on, right? That you don't have to pay attention to all that much.
Right, but somehow is a nice soothing thing in the background that can ease your tensions in this anxiety-plagued world.
Yeah, and I think during the holidays, you see this, that they make programming exactly for this, like the Yule Log.
Oh, yeah.
So Yule Log TV, but Hulu started doing a whole bunch of them called Streaming Wonderland. And so one of them is like a gingerbread house at a party. And then you see just for an hour, people breaking off bits of it and eating it. So I think they realize that people want something in the background.
All right. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Joshua Rivera. He's a GQ contributor, and Han Wen, senior editor for IndieWire. Coming up, how James Whiteside balances his life as a principal dancer for the American Ballet Theater and as a drag queen, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Ballet dancer James Whiteside posted a video for this song on YouTube back in 2011. It was under his pop persona, JB Dubs. Okay, he's flanked by two other dancers. The three of them wear white dress shirts, black skinny ties, not much on the bottom except for some briefs and killer red patent leather stilettos. I Hate My Job has gotten over 3.5 million views. And less than a year after it was posted, James Whiteside was singing a new refrain. He became a soloist for the American Ballet Theater. And in 2013, he was made a principal dancer for the ABT. He also models, he hosts a podcast, he dances with a drag troupe called the Dairy Queens, and he's here now. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Well, you have a lot of jobs.
Yes, I like to keep very busy.
That you all love. You don't hate any of those jobs, right?
No. If I'm picking a job, it's because I like it.
Okay, but I would imagine that it would take all of your time and energy just to be in the American Ballet Theater and be principal dancer on top of it.
In all honesty, when I was in Boston Ballet, I had a lot more downtime. I had more time to just sort of mess around and see creatively what I could come up with. And so that's why JB Dubs was born. And that's also why the Dairy Queens were born. We had a lot of free time, and I guess we were bored, so we made stuff. But upon joining American Ballet Theatre, my schedule started getting more and more booked, and I'm finding it more and more difficult to keep up these personas, which is tragic, if you ask me.
So you're really missing those other personas?
Yes, and I try to squeeze them in when I can, but when I first moved to New York City in 2012, I used to perform in nightclubs as not only JB Dubs, but as my drag persona named Yoo-Hoo Betch, named after the chocolate milk product. You know, I don't think there's any actual dairy in it, but you know, Yoo-Hoo, the chocolate drink.
But it's spelled U-H-U.
Yes, with an umlaut, just for no reason, just to further point out how ridiculous everything is. So I used to, you know, travel around with Suzanne Barsh, reigning New York City nightlife queen, and do drag shows hither and thither. And it was so much fun. But as my career with ABT started really ramping up, I found myself having less and less time to do drag or to make music, even just to write music.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not tragic because I am absolutely loving where I'm at in my ballet career right now. I feel very comfortable and confident and I feel like I'm getting to know the roles that I'm doing so well and to dive deeper into what I desperately want to do.
When you joined ABT, did they say to you, you got to tamp down the Yoo-Hoo Betch side?
No, they didn't. I mean, I feel all my life I'm expecting for people to tell me that, to say, cool it, crazy, you know? Uh-huh. But I'm sure they say it, but just not to me. So I am continuing to do the things that I desperately want to do.
Can you sneak some of that into the ABT? I know that they put on really traditional ballets. But is there any way to sneak any of that in there?
Well, it's all me. It's all one person. So inevitably, these things sort of creep in. And there are certain roles that I do that are not the typical standard prince. You know, I do a lot of that. But there are also other roles like Iago in Othello and Ballroom von Rothbart in Swan Lake. And those have a slightly kitschy side to them. And not everyone performs them that way, but it comes natural to me to sort of pump it up with that draggy camp in a way.
How would you do that on stage? What would that look like?
Well, my performances are pretty thought out, but when I get on stage, they tend to be rather spontaneous. So I often surprise myself with what I'm doing on stage that I never did in rehearsal.
Like
it's kind
what?
Of, oh gosh. At the end of Swan Lake, we run and jump off, like essentially a cliff, and land in the lake, quotations. But there's a huge mattress pad behind the set, so it looks like we're having this grand suicide on the crescendo of the music. And you never really know what you're gonna get. Some of the ballerinas sort of tip off the edge and plop down. Some people, you know, do a little jump off, and then every once in a while, you get someone who's really gung-ho. And this happened to me. I wasn't really planning on it, but my first Swan Lake, I ran up the ramp, and I saw the edge of the set where I'm supposed to jump off. And I thought to myself, hell, why not go for it? So I was running, and I did this huge swan dive, and I could hear the audience gasp because it looked terrifying. I thought, okay, maybe that's too much. But it was so much fun. And, you know, there are things like that that creep in here and there that you can't seem to predict.
And you just landed on a mattress.
You land on a mattress with a thwack. You know, it's rather painful, but it's very much worth it.
Can you talk a little bit about your training and how you became a ballet dancer? When did you first start training? How old were you?
I started dancing when I was 9 years old. And it was because my mom threw me a phone book and said, hey, pick something. You're driving me crazy. I found an ad for a dance studio in the phone book, and I showed it to my mom, and I said, I want to go here. And so she brought me to the dance studio, and I was immediately obsessed. The music, the movement, the energy, the camaraderie of the dancers, it was immediate for me. Mm. did jazz, tap, ballet, acrobatics, African dancing. It was fantastic. I loved it.
And so during high school and then beyond, were you doing it all the time? Were you really serious about it and knew that you wanted to be a professional dancer?
I knew that I wanted to be a professional dancer when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
I knew what my trajectory would be in a way. I knew that I wanted to join ABT after I saw them for the first time. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to be in ABT one day, and then I want to do Broadway. So I'm still waiting on the Broadway part, but I am very happy at ABT at the moment.
That is your ultimate dream, to do Broadway?
Well, I'd love to. It's not my ultimate dream. My ultimate dream is to do whatever I want.
Which it seems you're doing.
In a way. And I'd love to do Broadway. You know, I think it's a bucket list artistic dream.
Do you sing? Well, I guess you do sing. You sing in
the
videos.
I mean, moderately. I sort of rap sing. You know, hopefully there's a role for me that doesn't require, you know, Beyonce. Because Beyonce does not live within me.
Well, maybe you could lip sync.
That sounds cheap. That's what I do that already as a drag queen, okay?
Well, right. You're probably pretty good at it.
You bet I am.
Okay, you also maintain a pretty healthy presence on social media, on Instagram, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a purpose to that? Is it just fun or is it for promotion?
Well, at first it was just for fun. And then I realized that it is also an opportunity to engage with people who may not be getting into the theater too often. And I also want to just show people that as a principal ballet dancer, you don't have to conform to this mysterious, bunhead image. You know, this is exactly who I am. I have a lot of fun. I work incredibly hard. And I am rather cheeky.
You are rather cheeky. Well, when you talk about this bunhead image, so the image that we do have of traditional ballet dancers is they are pretty anonymous. I mean, with the exception of a Baryshnikov or a Nureyev, we don't really know their names. And why is that? Why are they? Is there something in ballet that stresses anonymity?
I don't believe so. I think there are stars like that now in a way, but it's not the same fervor that the 80s afforded. You know, now it's just a different world to exist in as a ballet dancer and as a human in general.
Yeah. Well, would you want to be that? Would you want to be a superstar where everyone knows your name?
No, I want the money of a superstar, first of all. I don't want to not be able to walk down the street. That's insane. I just don't know how people do that. But I do want the freedom to be able to explore creatively whatever I desire to.
When can we see you here in LA on stage?
The next time I'll be in California, I believe, will be for The Nutcracker with American Ballet Theater in December in Orange County at the Segerstrom Arts Center.
Okay, that's a great place.
Oh, it's a wonderful theater. They're very good to us.
All right. Well, James, it's been really fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. It's been great chatting.
That's James Whiteside. He's a principal dancer with the American Ballet Theater. Hi, Christian Bordahl.
Hey, Madeline Brand.
Do you have a drag name?
I don't. I'm going to have to think about that one.
Well, you have Resident Norwegian. I guess
Resident
that's
Norwegian
your drag name.
It doesn't sound like such a drag name, though, does it? I'll have to wear my...
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll
anyway,
figure that out.
So we were talking about, or you were talking about, this no drama TV earlier, and that got me thinking of Norwegian slow TV. Have you ever seen Norwegian slow TV? So it's this great thing. The first one was my favorite, which is they mount a camera on the front of a train that goes spend 7 hours going through the mountains from Oslo to Bergen. And all you do is you follow along as the train goes through the mountains, and it's really beautiful.
Mesmerizing.
They did one at knitting, where they like shear the wool and then they spin it and then they knit a sweater. It's all there. You just watch it from start to finish.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Norwegian Slow TV. It's on Netflix.
Okay. Our resident Norwegian, I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.